Blog Talk Radio.
Yo, this is your boy, G-Ski Rocks. And this is going out to the lovely, lovely women of the world. I know sometimes you have to make a hard decision, but I want you to think about this.
Pro-Life Fridays Radio here on Blog Talk Radio and the Invisible Conservative Show. I am your host, Letitia Wong. Welcome to another edition of Pro-Life Fridays Radio. We had taken a break last week for Good Friday and to celebrate with our families and with our close friends and brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ the resurrection of Jesus from the grave. So happy Easter to everybody. It is Resurrection Sunday every Sunday, but the anniversary that is celebrated, which is Easter Sunday, is particularly joyful for us believers. It's joyful for me. And so I want to wish everybody who's listening just a wonderful, happy Easter and in joyful celebration of Jesus, who is not dead. He is alive. He is alive indeed. So I want to start off our program with our usual scripture reading from Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 19. I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Choose life so that you and your descendants may live. Father, in the name of Jesus Christ, I lift up this program and every word that I say and all the words that come from our listeners and our speakers and our guests on the show, that you use it to communicate truth above all things. Communicate the truth of the life that you have given us. Help us or help our minds to be open to that which we in our society dare not think, which is that people are important and don't deserve to die just for existing. And I thank you for this program and the platform that we are provided to be able to get that message out. I thank you for our guests today, that you have brought them from the footsteps, from the doorstep of death and persecution to freedom and being able to tell their story here in the United States and abroad. I thank you for the book effort that they have and the story that they're going to tell us on the air today. I thank you, and I pray that our callers will also be bold and to say what's on their mind so we can really deal with some really hard and heart issues. And in the name of Jesus Christ, I pray, amen. All right, so I am your host, Letitia Wong. Welcome to Pro-Life Fridays Radio. The number to call in if you want to call in and make comments or ask a question to either myself, the host, or our guest who will be on in a little while. The number to call is 760-542-3907, and you will be calling into the Pro-Life Fridays Radio program. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest before I get into just so many headlines that we have. Woo! Kind of overwhelming. I don't really know what to pick first. Our guests are, and I apologize ahead of time if I butcher their names, Maryam Rastampour and Marzia Amirzadeh. I think I got that right. These two lovely women are believers in Jesus Christ who were caught and captured in Iran. And that is their home country, by the way. They're Iranian women who were put in prison for spreading Christianity, which is against the law in Iran. And they had spent a total of 9 months in prison, in not just any prison, but the worst prison that we've talked about on air on this program before. When we talk about Pastor Saeed Abedini, who is right now in prison, in that same prison, and we are going to hear from them and hear from their book, and they're on a book tour right now, so they're going to talk to us about just their experiences, the people that they met, and what the book is all about, and I am excited. I am head over heels excited for them to be here. And it is a great honor and privilege. So before we get to that, though, we have just so much stuff to talk about. and I want to also welcome our wonderful co-host, the Invisible One himself, Thomas Smith. How are you doing, Thomas?
What's up?
Hey. We're doing
How
a show
you?
Today.
You yeah, well, with us? I wouldn't know because I've been out of the loop.
You with us today? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here for the moment.
All righty. Well, it's good to have you on. It's good to have you here.
So who's your guest today?
Oh, you missed that part. I just finished introducing them. We'll be on during our... I think I'm just going to hold you in suspense until it's time to have them on.
No, I don't want to be held in suspense. I would like to know who the guests are today.
All right, Mr. Latecomer.
I was working.
Remember when we did our show with Randy Noble and Nagmeh Abedini. And we talked a little bit about the persecution in Iran. Well, the two women that we wanted to have on were not able to be with us that day. They are on with us today.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
So it's going to be a fantastic program. I'm so looking forward to it. But before we spend any more time talking about what's going to happen in a little while, let's talk about our headlines, which I am just chomping at the bit because there has been so much happening. I looked in my inbox today for my feed, and voila! Let's just start. Let's start with what I wrote down on the top of my paper, because they're not in any particular order, and we'll get to them one at a time. The Plan B drug, which is given, was needing required a doctor's prescription for women to obtain, has now gone over the counter. A judge has ruled that, the Plan B, abortifacient, we call it contraceptive, but it is an abortifacient drug, which is supposed to be used when your normal birth control method fails, or you suspected that it had failed. It's used for that purpose as a backup plan, so that a woman does not have a baby. Now gone over the counter because the judge overruled the Department of Health and Human Services and said we need more research, we need more time to provide research to make sure that this drug is safe enough for over-the-counter use. A judge has just overruled Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of the DHS. And said that drugstores must now carry, the drug can be carried completely over the counter, with no doctor's prescription necessary, and no obstacles in the way. There's no age limit or age restriction for it at all. Now, of course, if you can obtain Plan B drugs, just like you can any bottle of Tylenol. What could possibly go wrong? Oh, let me count the ways. First of all, it's
overdose.
Not going to be. Well, I don't know what an overdose is going to do. I mean, you're only supposed to take one pill. But first of all, I suspect that it is not going to. I think it will surprise people how many men will be purchasing this. Pill, not women. And I mean men who mean to do nefarious things to women and not have the women become pregnant and have to take care of this issue. It's already bad enough that there are women who are stuck in prostitution that have to get a monthly shot at the direction of their pimp to suppress their reproductive system so they don't get pregnant. But now if it's as easy as taking a pill after every time they're forced to have sex with a paid person, man. How many of those women are just going to be fed pills from now on? I think it's going to surprise the industry how many sales they're going to get. I mean, oh no, they're going to sell these. Well, there's going to be an abuse problem with this. I just know it. There's going to be an abuse. There can't be. There's no way there can't be an abuse problem with a drug like this. And not only that, I mean, the ridiculous and absurdity of it is beyond reason. I can't go into the drugstore and buy Sudafed. I mean the real Sudafed, not the pseudo-Sudafed, pseudo-Sudafed, the real Sudafed, because that stuff is located behind a locked counter because we're so afraid that people are making meth out of it, that your ordinary person who just wants to be able to breathe sometimes during cold and flu season has to jump through hoops and get all kinds of permission in order to obtain the real stuff. Otherwise, you get, you know what's in cold medicine nowadays? The pseudo ephedrine. It's basically an antihistamine. It's an allergy medication. It's not a nasal decongestant. It's not cough medicine. It's not cold medicine. It's an antihistamine. And while that might improve things for people who have a cold, it doesn't actually suppress symptoms of the cold. I know because I have taken the pseudo Sudafed. And it might make a 10% improvement in the way I feel. It doesn't take care of my symptoms so that I can feel like I can actually breathe or get out of bed or feel like getting around to doing something that I can do. So that is unavailable to the general public. To me as a woman, it's unavailable to me. But I can get a Plan B pill. No problem. Something that might destroy a life inside me because I'm afraid. I can get that. On top of that, Thomas, you wanted to say something about that? Thomas. All right.
No, I'm just listening. You got everything covered. I'm just listening on mute.
Well, you're part of the show too, buddy.
Well, you know my thoughts on it, so, you know.
All right. Well, we've got tons of headlines. And the biggest thing this past week was the explosive video that not even Planned Parenthood can lift their heads up out of their shame to give an adequate answer to. Their own spokeswoman. I believe it was Florida, in the Florida state legislature, their own spokeswoman was asked point blank if Planned Parenthood would support legislation basically a Born Alive Infant Protection Act in the state of Florida. And she argued against it. Now, we know that Planned Parenthood argues against this type of legislation all the time, every time. So there's no surprise about that. But when she was asked point blank by Florida legislators, what would happen to a child who was born alive after a failed abortion? What should happen to that child? And her response was that the mother of the child, the woman, and the doctor, and her doctors, have the right to decide what happens to that child next. Keep in mind, this baby has been born. And they asked her, the child is lying on the table. This baby okay, let's not call it a fetus anymore because he is outside the mother's body. He is what a lot of pro-choicers want to call officially a baby. What would she suggest do to that? And she said she kind of backed herself into the corner and she repeated, I think it's between a decision between the mother and the doctor. So, if the mother and the doctor both agree that this born infant should die, perhaps, let me add some commentary, perhaps with a pair of scissors to sever the spinal cord of this poor child in order to make the death a reality. That is an option that she would support and thereby Planned Parenthood would support. Wow. This just makes Planned Parenthood an institutionalized Kermit Gosnell. It does. Now, Kermit Gosnell, if the people don't know, if our listeners do not realize, is on trial at the moment for murdering at least one woman and a number of born alive infants at his abortion mill. He is on trial for murder. And Planned Parenthood, by way of this woman's testimony, has endorsed what he did. Not him personally, but they're saying they would endorse doing the same thing. I find this unbelievable, because I don't think that they would actually do that. I didn't think they would actually come out and say it that way. After birth abortion and infanticide has always been in the realm of the theoretical. It's been in the realm of the medical unethicist on the academic level, like from people like Peter Singer and Savulescu and Giublini and Minerva and those other infamous people today who have come out in favor of infanticide. It's been in that realm, people sitting around a table and a chalkboard and a whiteboard, poring over books, theorizing what the cost and benefit ratio of a human life. And basically valuing human life before a certain age to zero. Now, in real life, we don't say that because in real life, we understand that a person who is unborn has no value difference with a person who is born. As these medical ethicists say, we agree that there is nothing magical about a human being passing through the birth canal that happens to give them to produce some kind of inviolable right to life. You either have it or you don't. If you don't have it at a certain point in time, then you've never had it as a fundamental right. So, we have here Planned Parenthood coming out and saying that she basically approves, and thereby Planned Parenthood approves, of an afterbirth abortion. And, well, Planned Parenthood tried to walk it back a little bit and tried to divorce themselves from her comments, but they really can't. You know, she's a paid representative for them. And if she didn't get her story straight, what is the story? There is no backtracking to this. And to piggyback on this, there was a story today that I want to quote from that says in 2010, up to 1,270 babies were born alive after failed abortions. Just in the U.S. alone, and just in 2010. And these are, let me qualify it again, these are just the figures of those that are of reported born alive babies. There are plenty of unreported born alive babies, just as there are plenty of unreported abortions. But the hearing went on. I think it's still in the state of Florida. And it came out saying that the records show that there were a total number of 1,270 babies born alive in 2010 after failed abortions. Wow. Where are those people? Did those 1,270 born alive infants receive medical attention? No, they didn't. Most of them did die because of injuries sustained in abortion, and they call that mortality subsequent to abortion. So, I mean, what are we going to do? I mean, if Planned Parenthood is in support of afterbirth abortion, it doesn't, the consequences of this is that doctors, abortion doctors, can all be Kermit Gosnell. They can all suck at their jobs, the jobs they created for themselves. They can all suck as abortionists and not kill children in the womb, which is what an abortion is, killing within the womb. They can actually do such a sucky job, deliver a live, injured baby, and then finish the job outside the womb, say with some scissors in the back of the neck. Every procedure then can be done the way a partial birth abortion can be done. With this type of admission, with this type of no protections, an endorsement of afterbirth abortion, you're going to see a huge jump in brutality against infants. I'm not sure if the American conscience can take that, but I have my suspicions that we're probably going to be convinced that we must. And it's going to be classified as one of those necessary evils that we all have to put up with and we're all uncomfortable with, but you know, it's a woman's right. So, you know, I mean, that's for your information. Last night I went to see this film that aired in St. Louis at the AMC 12 near my home. And I was so glad to be able to go because I got to see and meet tons of pro-life people that came out for this film. The film is called It's a Girl. And basically it's about female gendercide. It's a documentary film talking about the cultural and ethical background. I shouldn't say even ethical, but that's how the sociological background behind the practice of killing only females. The film centered around the country of India and countries of India and China. But it is a global society. They didn't talk about the instances of gendercide in other countries, in Western countries here in the United States. Now, granted, you can only put so much information in one documentary. They had about five or six stories of individuals that were either victims or perpetrators of this culture of death. So the premise of the film is to talk about how much male children are valued over female children. And to make a long story short, and because I know people would want to ask, what's the big deal? You know, women are equal to men. You know, this is so silly. Why carry this on? Well, in that culture, and I hesitate to call it patriarchy. They call it patriarchy. I don't think that's the right word. Let me search for a word that I think is more appropriate. But basically, the society is not simply wrapped around the future of male children. The inheritance and the namesake of a family goes to the male children. So while a family wants to have male children themselves, they do not want to have children who are female, because it's almost an economic thing. And it lets you say that it is all about, oh, family economics, not wanting to be poor and all that stuff. The people who are from India say that it is not a matter of economics, personal finances. It is a matter of greed. The more male children you have, the more their future spouse's family is going to have to give you in wealth, in their personal wealth. So it's a money-making scheme. It's a matter of greed. And if you have a daughter, you're going to be the one paying somebody else to marry your daughter. So what has happened is there's a huge birth disparity between the male children and the female children. So what has happened is in India, girls are routinely aborted. There has been such a misuse of ultrasound technology, especially by those with the money and the means, to obtain ultrasounds on pregnant women, that once they determine that a fetus is a female, they then often go on to abort those females. And so I'm watching this film and I'm thinking to myself, how does this even make cultural sense, a personal sense, just common sense? Because here I am watching this film and these are women who are admitting to the world that they themselves have killed their own daughters. The film opens up with a woman who is, she looks a little, I don't know, I can't really tell the ages of women sometimes from other countries, but she looks like she's almost middle-aged. And she points, in the film, she points to all the grave sites where she has buried her infant daughters, who she admits she strangled. After they were born. And she says, I've had eight. Meaning she's had eight daughters whom she has strangled and buried in a field somewhere. And it's very hard to listen to, because you look at her and you're like, but you are a woman. You are a woman. What if somebody killed you? And the rationale for that is, oh, you know, these girls would have lived the worst life being alive today if I didn't kill them. The 3 minutes that it takes to kill a child is better than the 30 years of hardship and suffering that they will experience if they lived. And I thought that was so heartbreaking. What a bleak outlook on the future of another person, especially your own flesh and blood. And I can see, I can sense that, and then, you know, the look on people's eyes is not of concern. That is what they say. I feel for this woman who is in this film, because that was her rationale. I don't want my daughters to suffer for being girls, so I killed her. I killed them. But you look at her, she has no remorse. She has no remorse. She doesn't regret having done what she did. And I somehow, you know, and you look across a room full of Indian women who have been told to describe how they've killed their infant daughters, some by poison, some by strangulation, some by suffocation. And they all justify it as this is life, you know. Not all of us can live, so, you know, we get to choose who lives and who dies. We are the givers of life, and we can take it away. And, you know, that really sounds a lot like a woman's right to choose, doesn't it? It does. And if Planned Parenthood cannot come out and admit, yeah, we are for infant death, you know, I hope the public can see past their extremely shoddy PR backwards move at this point in trying to cover up for their own paid spokesman's words. So I recommend seeing the film, It's a Girl, if it comes to your town. I think in the future it'll be broadcast. No, I think it'll be made available via DVD. And people can rent the film probably in the future. They can probably buy it off of the website for it. It's a girl.com. I think it's a girl movie.com. The director is Evan Gray Davis. This is not his first kind of humanitarian based film. And I wish I will probably dedicate more time to talking about the film in the future, because I think it's so interesting, and I actually want people from the film to come and comment on it, because I think this is not something that gets talked about often enough. But I want to move on to our guests. So coming up, we have our guests for today, Miriam and Marzia. I will not try to say their last names again. And first, we're going to take a very short break and come back with our guests. So you're listening to Pro-Life Fridays Radio. If you'd like to call in, the number to call in is 760-542-3907. And we'd love to hear you on the air ask a question of our guests or of myself. And we'll be right back.
Hands up, open wide. Put your hands up side by side. Age don't matter, like race don't matter, like place don't matter, like what's inside. Let the kick drum kick one time. Breathe out, let your mind unwind. Eyes on the ceiling, looking for the feeling. Wide open, let your own eyes shine. Yeah, it's where the fight begins. Yeah, underneath the skin. Beneath these hopes and where we fight comes from the fight within.
You are with my wonderful co-host, Thomas. Sometimes he's mute. Hey.
Hello.
Hello. If you have questions or would like to talk to our guests, the number to call in is 760-542-3907. We would love to hear from you. And with us today, I have two wonderful ladies that I've just learned of their story. In fact, I actually learned of their story a couple of years ago when they were in prison. And it's an interesting story. Let me quickly say that one of my favorite apologists, Dr. William Lane Craig, had learned of their story when he was abroad in Europe. And he had spoken on air of their incredible faith in Jesus Christ while they were in prison. And how it just seemed to me, listening to what he was saying, that the Holy Spirit was giving them just incredible words to say. I mean, I could not be, I was shocked. I mean, I was so shocked that what they had to go through and that they came out of this protected by God. They are now here in the United States. They've written a book about their experiences. And you know, I am just thrilled to death to have them on the show. As I said earlier, we have Miriam and Marzian, who wrote the book, Captive in Iran. And they are right now on a book tour talking about the book, doing book signings, and talking to multiple audiences about their experiences. So I am welcome. I'm so pleased to have these lovely women and sisters in Christ on our show today. So welcome, Miriam. Welcome, Marzia, to Girl Life Fridays Radio.
Thank you so much. First, I would like to thank you for having in your show.
Thank you so much. So I have been following you on Facebook, like so many people have. Watching you, you were on Fox News earlier this week. You've been on many radio programs. You've been on in front of churches. Tell us a little bit what you were talking about, your story. So let's start off by telling us what you've told your other audiences.
Yeah, you know, our story is about our imprisonment and what we experienced in prison for 9 months. And it's not just about our story. It's not just about us being in prison. And as you heard in some churches or some medias, we are going to be a voice for voicelesses and those who don't have any voice in Iran and also in other countries, those who are still in suffer, who are still in prison because of their faith. And also there are other prisoners who are not in prison just because of their faith. There are some political prisoners, like students, that they have to stay in prison for years and years. And here we are going to share our story and also the story of those people. And also we wrote the story of many women in our book, and we are going to share the story of those women when we talk in public.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So tell me a little bit about why how you ended up in prison in Iran.
The first day I received a call from a stranger in the morning, and he asked me some question about my car documents and asked me to go to the police station. Since this call was unusual for me, I called one of my friends who was a lawyer and asked him to give me some advice, and he assured me that there would be no problem. When I went to the police station, there they took all my documents, handcuffed me, and told me that you're under arrest of being a Christian and evangelizing. And after that, they sent three guards with me to search our apartment. without any search warrant, and they took both of us to the police station and ransacked all our apartments. With all, they took both of us to police station with all our belongings, CDs, books, and everything that they discovered in our house. And for the first day, the whole first day, we were in that police station, and we had a very heavy interrogation. And after late at night, they sent us to another detention, which called Vozara. And we were there for 15 days. And after that, they sent us to Evin prison.
Okay. So did you not have a trial? And you did not have any lawyers present? Did anybody defend you?
No, at that time, for about 6 months, we didn't have any lawyer. They didn't allow us to have a lawyer.
But we had trials. We had about 10 courts, and during the time that we were in detention and in Evin prison, they sent us to many courts, but all those courts were not public. They were held in a revolutionary court. But we every time we were there in front of the judge without a lawyer, as Marzia said, we were not allowed to have a lawyer.
Oh, so did your family know what happened to you? Did you have anyone looking after you at all?
No, actually, because Maryam and I, we had a mission in Iran, and as you know, the situation of Iran is very dangerous for these kind of activities, and we preferred not to have relationship with our families, so they didn't know about us, just our sisters. They find out that we are in prison.
Oh, okay. So you were sent to prison, and without much legal representation, what did they charge you with? And did they find you guilty? A judge found you guilty?
After 14 days, the judge sent us to prison with anti-government charges. It was a political charge. And we were not political prisoners, but, there is no charge like apostasy or blasphemy or Christianity in the constitution of Iran. And it was not legal to send us with these charges, so they had to send us to prison with some political charges. So our first charge was anti-government, but after a few months, they couldn't prove anything that shows we were political prisoners, so... Then they changed our charges to apostasy, blasphemy, and evangelizing and spreading Christianity in Iran according to Sharia law, which is an Islamic law.
Right. So when you went to prison, what was that like? Now, we have had a previous program. We had Nagmeh Abedini on our program to talk a little bit about this prison that her husband, Saeed Abedini, is in. And, we hear that it is a very terrible prison, that the prisoners are often beaten and mistreated. Was that your experience?
Yes, this prison is it's very notorious for arresting, raping, torturing, and executing of many innocent people. And as you know, there are many innocent people there, like lawyer, journalists, doctors, and many religious people. They are still in this prison, and because they are against of the wrong rules of Islam, and their belief is against of the wrong rules of Islam, and their opinion is against of Iranian government, and that's why they arrest many people and put them in the prison. And there are also many students who are in this prison, and they are still suffering.
It's I would like to add something here. Evin prison is of course, prison is prison, and nobody enjoy spending his or her time in prison. But Evin is really notorious because especially for political prisoners or religious prisoners, because they received much worse treatment from guards, from the interrogators. It's not just physical torture. It's both physical and mental torture. For example, Marzi and I were not allowed to see a doctor for 9 months. We were both sick. We were suffering from many diseases. Marzi was suffering from tooth pain, headache, and her kidneys had problem. I was poisoned twice, but they didn't let us to see a doctor, and they were all physical torture. Like Said, we are hearing these days that he's suffering from internal bleeding, and I'm sure that there is not, you know, enough and adequate medical equipment or doctors, or even if it was, they wouldn't let Said to visit a doctor. And also, we believe that mental torture is worse than physical torture. The interrogations, we had the experience of hours and hours of interrogations by two interrogators, and we believe it was worse than physical torture. And I'm sure for Said is the same.
Right. What would they say to you if they were, when they give you took you in for interrogation? What would they say to you? How would they treat you?
Their behavior was so brutal and humiliating, and most of the time they try to force us to deny our faith. And their main problem was with our faith, and they try to convince us that we made a wrong decision. And I remember once they invited a professor, theology professor, during our interrogation in order to convince us that we made a wrong decision. And we usually told us that you shouldn't talk about Christianity with young people, because you are guide them to their wrong way. And we had many discussions like this, that you shouldn't do this in this country. This country has law, and you cannot do these activities, which is against law. But we try to tell them that we just obey the God. Not we don't want to, you know, we don't want to disobedient from Iranian law, but we would like to obey God's law, not people's law.
Mm-hmm. So did they? Were you ever physically tortured, or you ever physically mistreated and abused?
We were threatened to physical torture, especially during the first week when we were in the security police. And they sent us to a cell, a very dark and dirty cell in the basement. And they told us that you need to give all the information about your friends, like their names, their addresses. Otherwise, we will beat you until you vomit blood. And they transferred us to a cell. We were both so scared, and we thought that it was our last day. And you know, when I'm saying that mental torture is worse, I mean it because, like, the day that I'm talking about, they just sent us to that cell. We were just praying for each other. We hugged each other. We said goodbye to each other because we were thinking that that was our last day. And we were in that cell from early in the morning until 11 at night, but nobody came for us. And every minute we were waiting for them to come and torture us physically.
Wow. Wow. I think that was probably the point then, to have you just be afraid for all that time. Well, I have a special guest, a caller, who has been hanging very patiently on the line. He is my friend and yours, Randy Noble, who happens to live here in St. Louis with me. I mean, not with me, but he lives in St. Louis, too. So, Randy, are you there? Did you want to ask
her
a question? Awesome.
It is a pleasure and an honor to meet you, Mary Marzea, your Facebook friend, Randy. And I'm just thankful to God that 3 years ago, my prayers were answered for you, and you're free, and God has rewarded your suffering with an incredible opportunity to tell your story and to be a voice for the voiceless. And I'm just so thankful that you have a book out that the church needs to read. I wanted to just say a couple things and ask you a question, if that's okay. The two words that strike home to me about your book is fearless and faithfulness, faithfulness to Jesus. You were in a situation where it would have been easy at times to deny your faith, and you stood strong in the grace of God. And I know you have a message for Christians who have not one idea of the suffering that you went through. And I want to know from your heart, each of you, what is the message you have for the church?
Thank you so much, Randy. It's really an honor for both of us to finally hear your voice. And we so appreciate your support, not just for us, but for all Iranians. We can see that you have a great heart and passion for Iranians, and you have a voice for them. You are a voice for them, and God bless you. About those two words that you mentioned, fearless and faithfulness. I had just one thing that I want to say here. When we were in prison, we were so weak. We are both human. We are both human beings with all our weaknesses. And we are not heroes. We are not sacred. We are not, you know, we are not something that it's above other people. We are just human beings. And we were both so scared. And even sometimes we couldn't talk. Our mouth was dry. We were so pale. And we were just praying. The only thing that strengthened us during those times was God's grace and His power. God is our hero. We always say, tell people that God is our hero. We don't want to give praise to people, and all praise is for God. And if God was not with us during those times, and if He didn't help us in prison, we would have a break like many other people. And we really thank Him for being with us, for strengthening us, and for giving us this power to stay. That is what we always want to say it with loud voice.
I understand. Marzia, the words that you spoke to the interrogator, the boldness that you used, you told him like it was from your heart. You did not allow him to patronize you. You told him that you would not deny your faith, even though they would try in so many ways to twist your words. How do you get that kind of courage?
Hello, Randy. I'm happy to hear your voice here, too. I'm really appreciative for your support on Facebook and other ways. And I always, when I talk to Mariam, we really became so encouraged at how an American has this passion for Iranian people and other nation to pray for them and support them. We really thank you. Thank you.
It's my
pleasure.
You
know, Randy, when I was in that prison, as Mariam told, we are just two ordinary people. We are not hero, and we believe that just God used us in order to show His power to many people in that prison, to the authorities in Iran. And during that time, we had all weaknesses. There were sometimes that we were so scared and pale. But just we trust God, and Holy Spirit really strengthened us. And during our interrogation, when I had this discussion with my interrogator, when they wanted to convince me, I tried to tell them and show them that, you know, I'm not just I didn't just convert it to a religion. I actually, if you read our testimony in the book, you can see that we both have many personal relationship with Jesus. We had met Him, touched His love, and had seen many miracles during the time we converted to Christianity. And I told him that you cannot separate Jesus from me, because it's in all my self. If you want to kill me, you can kill me. You can
if you cut each part of my body, but you cannot separate Jesus from me, because it's in my heart, it's in each cell of my body, and it's not possible. When you, we are both in love with Jesus. We didn't just we don't just follow their religious rules. And when you are in love with Jesus, I think nobody is important in this world for you. Even they, other people kill you or threaten you. Nothing is important compared to keep your relationship with Jesus. And we all the time, it was an honor for both of us, because Jesus in Bible says, "For it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ, not just to believe in him, not just to follow him, also to suffer for him." And it was an honor for both of us to suffer for our faith. And as a follower of Jesus, it was very important for us to pass through this test with victory.
Well, your book is absolutely life-changing. Any Christian that reads this book is going to be reduced to tears, but they're also going to be called to take up their cross and follow Jesus. I know that it's done that to me. One of the things at the end of the book, I just want to say before I have to leave here, one of the most beautiful moments was when you and Marzea returned to your apartment after being released before trial, and you sat down together on the apartment floor and wept because your best friend, Shirin Al-Mahouri, you had heard had been executed.
Yes.
And to me, what you're saying to me in that scene is that although I'm thankful I'm free, my heart is with my friends that are still suffering in prison. And that's just a beautiful scene.
Thank you so much, Randy. Thank you for your prayers and for your support. God bless you.
God bless you.
Thank you so much, Randy. Thank you for calling, Randy. Now, I'm going to put you back on mute, and you can listen to the rest of the interview. And so Randy will still be with us, even though he's on mute. All right?
Yes, I will.
Okay. Well, that is wonderful. So I want to continue asking you questions about now, there were other people in prison with you, other Christians. Now, were they in prison also for the same thing that you were, which is, let me tell our audience really quick before you answer, that from the book description on your website, on the website for the book, it said that both of you had together passed out New Testament Bibles to about 20,000 people in Iran. That's a lot. That's a lot of New Testaments. 20,000, and you started church services for prostitutes in Iran, as well as other women. And so you were holding church
yes.
services in your home, and you were passing out Bibles.
Yes. You know, Mariam and I, in 2005, we were in Turkey for studying theology for about 6-7 months. And after that, when we returned to Iran, we had this passion in our hearts for evangelizing Iranian people. As you know, in Iran, there is just a false and distorted version of Bible, and people cannot find the real version of Bible. And we both had this passion in our heart to distribute Bible in Iran. And God, I remember one day God spoke to me through Bible and show me Iran is like a big land that has no seed in this land. And first, we need to put this seed in this land, and I will grow this seed by Holy Spirit, by rain. And we decided to do this, and I want to say that we, for these 20,000 New Testaments, we didn't evangelize like giving to the hand of people. We God showed us to distribute all these New Testaments in different parts of Tehran, and we bought a huge wall map, and and started from north of Tehran to the south. And every at night, usually at night, we carried about 114 New Testaments each in our backpack and visited one area and put them in the mailboxes. And but apart from that, every day we went for shopping, eating at restaurant, or doing our chores, we were talking to people and handing them a Bible as a gift. And as you mentioned, we had also two house churches, one for prostitutes and the other one for young people in our own apartment.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it makes me feel like, though, that, you know, many of us who enjoy so much freedom here in the United States, we aren't beaten. And, you know, it's not illegal to be a Christian. It's not illegal to share your faith. It's not illegal to give a Bible to somebody here in the United States. Yet we don't do that very much here. And yet people in other countries, like Iran, are risking their lives just to give out, you know, one Bible away, much less 100 at a time. I hope that fellow believers here in the United States, you know, listening to the show, and in any other free country, that we have the freedom to believe and the freedom to share our faith, can really pick that up and say we need to take our opportunities and our freedoms not for granted anymore, and use that opportunity because it can be lost. God created us to live in the countries that we do with. You know, if we are blessed with the privilege of having freedom of religion, maybe we ought to use that freedom, you know, before it gets taken away. And so I'm just, my heart is touched for all the things that you have done. And let me ask you a couple more questions about the Iranian treatment of Christians. And now you say they do follow Sharia law, which tells them that Christians may not start new churches and may not talk about their faith or spread Christianity. But is that also against the civil law, the legal law in Iran, or is just Sharia?
As I mentioned earlier, it's not. We don't have something like this in the in the civil law that says, you know, Christianity is legal, or converting to Christianity is legal, or even talking about your faith. But it's all according to the Sharia law. But there were times that in 2009, we had this conversation with our interrogator. He was trying to tell us that, you know, by distributing Bibles, by talking to young people, by converting them from Islam to Christianity, you know, it's against the rules of the government. And because these governments try to keep their power, and their power is based on Islam, and you know, they consider this a big threat if people, especially young people, convert to Christianity. It's not just about you know, Islamic law or Sharia law. It's also about keeping the power.
Right, right. How many people would you say, now I don't know if it's an accurate number or not, but how many people do you think in Iran have heard of Jesus and believe, have become Christians?
We cannot estimate exactly how many people, but we are sure that there are many people who are Christian, and there are many underground churches in Iran, which is not clear, and we don't know exactly how many people. You know, when we were in Iran and we were talking to people and evangelizing, people were Iranian people are very thirsty and hungry about hearing the message of salvation. Because, as you know, these days persecution in Iran, there is persecution, and the situation of Iranian people are not good. And people usually they are looking for a savior. And when we talked to them about the God grace, God love, most of them, they were very eager to hear about God. And because there are many wrong rules in Islam, and Islamic theology, usually they teach them that you cannot to be close with God, and God is like one who rule over the human rights and punish them for the slightest sin. And they cannot believe this, that they can be very close to God and have a relationship. And when we talk to them, they most of them, they are very eager and they are very happy to hear about Jesus. And I know, I'm sure that there are many Iranian people that they are converted to Christianity.
Wow, that is wonderful to hear. And so when you were released, so now you've spent 9 months, and it was not a pleasant experience at all. You were very much mistreated and denied basic health care. And tell us a little bit, how did you get released just one day?
You know, they were not supposed to release us. They were supposed to execute us by hanging. But because of we believe that the first reason that we are free today, it's God's grace. And it was just about God's timing. God wanted us to be in prison for 9 months because he wanted us to bring his hope and his love to our fellow prisoners, and also to guards, and also to give his message, message of salvation to many people. And that was just God's grace that we are free today. But the second reason is people's support, either by praying or sending letters to prison, which, you know, these days we encourage people to continue pray for those who are still in prison, like Said Abedini and the other Iranian pastor, Fashi Fathi, it's been 3 years that he's in prison, and he has to stay there for 3 more years. And there are, you know, apart from these two young men, there are many other Christians who are in prisons, not just in Evin, in prisons in other cities in Iran, and they're suffering. We just want to encourage people to continue their support by praying for them, by sending letters to Evin Prison. We put the names of prisoners on our website, captiveiniran.com, and also the address for Evin Prison. And people can send prisoners letters, and which can make a huge difference. And that was one of the reasons that we got released. And also, Iranian government was under lots of pressure from some international and big organizations like United Nations, Amnesty, and even Pope from Vatican sent a letter to Iranian government, and they asked about our case. And because of all these pressures, the Iranian government had to release us, because they wanted to show the world that there is religious freedom in Iran, which is not true. Mm. And we all know that there are still many people who are in prison.
Wow. And so for the 9 months that you were there, you were able to share Jesus Christ with other prisoners.
Yes. Every day we had many opportunities to talk to people about Jesus, and they were so receptive.
Oh, wow.
And you know,
that
we believe that we were more free inside the prison to talk about Jesus because we were in prison. But when we were outside, we had to pray and ask God to show us right people, right persons to talk about Jesus. But inside the prison, we had many opportunities to share the message of salvation because we were in prison, and we were more free rather than outside the prison.
Wow. So I looked at, there was a picture, I think maybe one of you posted, it looked like a dormitory, it looked like a prison, where it is just a room and it is just filled with bunk beds. Was that kind of the way that you were imprisoned? If you were in a room with many other women?
You know, that picture belonged to a public
section in Evin prison, but
okay.
If you search the Evin prison, you can see some pictures, but you know they usually put the best pictures, but the room that we were in public, it wasn't like this, it wasn't clean like this, but we have just this picture. We don't have good pictures from that prison. Nobody is allowed to take a photo. But it's they usually took some good picture from some good area in that prison and show other people that this is the prison, this is a good place, it's not dirty, it's not bad, which is not true.
Ah. Well, I'm glad you said that because, I mean, that's kind of the kind of information that we need to know. We need to know, you know, exactly how prisoners are being treated. I think, you know, this is the Pro-Life Fridays radio program. We need to know how people are being treated. I mean, I think it's a very dehumanizing thing to try to put somebody into prison for the purpose of getting them to reject their faith. You know, I'm not speaking just as a Christian, but it is not acceptable for any religion to do that to anybody else. This is a matter, you know, this is what they have decided to do. This, they are not breaking a civil law. This is, they're not committing a crime that should be punishable with prison time just for believing something different than the government, you know, be it political or religious. So, you know, I feel so much for you. I can't wait to, your publicist has said she's sending me a book. and I really appreciate that because then I get to read it and I'm very excited. So, you know, Jessica's listening. I'm waiting for my book. And, you know, I can't wait to read the details about it. Now, you are here in the United States, and I want to tell our audience that you are on a book tour. So you are signing your book, and you're going everywhere talking about it. Did you ever think that this was going to be your life after you left the prison and leaving Iran?
Yes, we were sure that God had a plan for us. You know, in each step of our lives, in Marzi and I, you know, God usually show us what we should do and His plan to us. And we believe that He had a plan for us in prison. And also today, now we are living in a free country. We are sure that He has a plan for us here too. It's not just about our own life. It's about what we are going to do to glorify God. We are, as you mentioned, we are on book tour, and our first goal here is to be a voice for voiceless by spreading the message of our book. And also, we are working on. We have planned to work on the second book, which is just about women in Islam and how Islamic rules can affect women, and not just in Iran and also in different countries. We think that God wants us to, you know, be a tool in His hands to be a voice for people, and especially for women in Islam. And for our personal life, we are at the school, we are studying, we have planned to continue our education in the fields of human rights in order to be an advocate for our people.
Wow, you know, that excites me because that is a very exciting topic for me. I would love to stay in touch with you, and as you learn, as you get more involved, because we have talked about women in Islam before on the show, and specifically the many instances of honor killing because of the pro-life issue here. But it is something that I'm really interested in. I would love to keep in touch with you and talk about those things. One last question before I let you go. What has been the response to your book? I know that you've had a lot of churches give you very positive response. Have you also gotten negative responses? And what have people said?
But we haven't received any negative response until today.
Awesome.
And you know, we just received people's love, and it's so encouraging for us, because before, when we were in prison, we were hearing that people were praying for us, and it was so encouraging for us. Now, when we are here, we go to churches or other events, and when we see how people are interested in our stories and the story of other people who are in prison, and how they try to support us, they try to love us, and it's so strengthening for us today to see their faces, not just hearing about them. And it's you know, we really appreciate their support. We always tell people that you are our Christian family. We don't feel that we are in a you know, in a foreign country. We have a big Christian family here, and we are so proud of them.
That's the way it should be. That is the way it should be. It really should. I lied. I have one more question. what do you want Americans to know, American Christians to know? Because I feel like, as an American, we don't know what's happening. We don't know enough about what's happening in other parts of the world. And we need people like you to tell us, because you've come from there. What is it that we should know? Just basically, you know, as even as believers, or the human rights issue, what is it like that we need to know and pray about? Not just for the people, but for other things.
You know, maybe there isn't persecution now in America, but as a Christian, we must be responsible for those who are in persecution and in suffer in other countries and other places. Because in Bible says when one part suffers, other parts should suffer with it, and it's very important. And especially for American who live in freedom, because they have many sources, and there are many ways that they can support others in persecution countries. For example, by praying for these people, for us, by sending letters, as we mentioned, it was very encouraging for us, and it's a huge help and changed the situation in for prisoners. And when we believe that when public speak out, it's a big change, and people can. There are also other ways that they can inform other organization on influential organization to know about what is going on in those countries like Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and about those dark and brutal places like Evin prison. And we can show we can by our support, we can show them that these people are not alone. And we can show our objection to such a brutal behaviors, and which is very important.
Wonderful. And so people can get more information about how to be involved, how to share their voice, from the website, captiveiniran.com.
Yes.
Wonderful.
And we will add more names, yeah.
Oh, great. That's wonderful, people. So if you... So from our listeners and our audience, if you want more information about the book, please purchase the book. It is now available in bookstores. Is it every bookstore, almost all major chains?
Yeah, it's all bookstores, and also in if they go to captiveiniran.com, it's just automatically link them to five stores like Amazon, Lifeway, Barnes & Noble, and they can pre-order it online too.
Wonderful. So, hey, ladies and gentlemen, there's no excuse not to get this book and read about Miriam and Marzia's experience and how to get involved, especially if you are a believer in Jesus Christ. It would be a very good idea for you to just educate yourself on what is happening in Iran, especially as now we don't have just one brother in Christ. He is one that we are trying very hard to get released from prison. That is Saeed Abedini. But there are many Christians who are in prison for their faith in Iran. We want brothers and sisters in the faith to pray for them, to get involved, to make our voices heard, and use our freedom that we are blessed with to advocate for people that can't do that for themselves right now. And I want to thank so much our two wonderful guests, Maryam Rostenpour, Marzia, will you say your last name for me?
Amirizadeh.
Great. I can't say it myself.
Okay, that's fine.
And I want to thank the Lord for you being on our program and for spending this time sharing with us. I would really love to have you back on in the future. And so please keep me in mind, keep the show in mind, and God bless you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for sharing. Have a great
God bless
night.
You.
God bless you on your
Thank
book tour.
Thank you.
And
you too.
If people can see when the next town you're going to be in signing books, they can look that up too, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, great. So I want to take the time that we have left in the show, just to reflect a little bit and bring this home for our audience. This is Pro-Life Fridays Radio, and we have made no I've not beaten around the bush at all about this program being what it is. It is not just about abortion, although pro-life is primarily about the pro-life issue, about the abortion issue, because it is so prominent in our culture. It is the last legal form of civil rights abuse that we have in the country that is actively being fought for by the pro-abortion end of the conversation, and its subsidiaries, things like reproductive technology, and just the abuse of women and children and the unborn for commercial means. I mean, it is slavery all over again. And I will never stop saying that as long as this program is available for us to say it, and also beyond. But beyond that, the pro-life issue is about religious persecution. It is about things like stem cell research and reproductive technology and slavery and all those things that we have mentioned on the program before. And what these two women have experienced at the hands of persecutors is a pro-life issue. They walked away from this persecution and imprisonment, but many others haven't. And God bless them. They have been given the opportunity, the voice, the strength, the means to share their story, and we would be foolish to turn away and ignore it, either by saying that we don't have time or saying we don't have an interest in it. And as I want to tell you, especially if you are a believer in Jesus Christ, this is an interest to you. It's directly from the Bible that we are to pray for our brothers and sisters in prison and to attend to them whenever possible. There are so many examples. There are more examples of Christians being imprisoned, beaten, tortured, and killed in the Bible than there are taking over countries and ruling governments and all that stuff. In fact, that is not in the Bible at all, taking over countries and ruling governments. So this is far from being a political issue. This is a fundamental pro-life issue. I mean, if you are a Christian in another country, you are thought of as little more than subhuman. You could choose to be human by changing your religion. You could choose to be human by agreeing with political statements of the government, whatever it happens to be, if it is a communist government or an Islamic government or anything other outside of that. Even governments that are so-called Christians in Western Europe, Christian governments, have human rights abuses based on this. They have legalized abortion. They do allow persecution of one religious group against another. They allow it. It might be against the law, but they allow it. The persecution that Maryam and Marzia have experienced, and scores of other Christians, political prisoners, students, dissidents of all kinds, people that we would say aren't breaking the law if they were here in the United States, they're in prison right now, and they're in the worst prison in Iran. They're human beings, too, that are being mistreated. And as a Christian, I think it is my responsibility, if I can't do anything else, to pray. Pray first and foremost for my brothers and sisters in Christ who are suffering for the sake of Jesus Christ and for the people that surround them that are there for other reasons that are suffering for whatever they believe in that the government has said you can't have. You know, you can't have this opinion. That justice will be done for them. So, I mean, in light of what we talk about predominantly, and it falls right in line, the dehumanization of individuals based on, you know, a condition is a pro-life issue. And it really came home for me. I'm going to talk a little bit about, because I saw this last time, I'm going to go back to talking about the It's a Girl film, because something that I just said just kind of came home to me. One of the, you know, I wish I had taken notes during the film, but it was dark. I wouldn't have been able to see. One of the commentators had said, and let me remind you that it's a girl film, was about the female genocide, the female gendercide that's happening in India and China, which is the two countries that were talked about in the film. And just the human rights advocates that are there have said, it's all right if we say, you know, let's save the girl children and hold up a poster and say, India, a place like India, a country like India should end this practice. Now, let me remind you that sex determination in India is against the law. Abortion, selective abortion, is against the law. But despite that, it's practiced frequently and widely, and nobody is prosecuted for that. And nobody is prosecuted for forcing a woman to have an abortion if the baby she is carrying is a girl. And I want to say about this film that one of the activists had said, it's one thing to say, let's all save the baby girls in a country like India. But who are we talking to? And that was the question that kind of floored me from the film. When we hold up a poster, who are we talking to? Let's save the baby girls. Let's not abort the baby girls. Well, who's we and who's let's? She said that we need to kind of turn those posters into mirrors and show that it is not simply something that happens from, you know, as individual isolated circumstances, that it is a culture that accepts the death, however uncomfortably or however unjustified it is, or however they justify it or rationalize it, however that is a separate issue. How do we need to address the culture of death that exists within the mindset of the dominant Indian culture and the mindset of the dominant Chinese culture, and might I say also a mindset that does the same thing here in the United States, American culture. We accept the death of deaths of a certain class of person as something that is allowable, whether it's legal or not, it's really not important, but it is allowable. We make allowances for others to do these things. We make allowances for ourselves to say, that's okay that I do this, even though I may oppose this practice. In general, that's what's happening. During the film, they ran across the screen. They showed proverbs, several Hindi proverbs, Chinese proverbs, sayings that devalue women, that devalue daughters, that devalue female children. They're seen as resource drainers. There was one that said, the day a baby girl is born is the day a thief has come into the house. There's one, and there are several that express the same sentiment as that. It's very dehumanizing. It's very unloving, to say the least. It's unloving to say that about a female child just for being female. And so this woman said, we need to turn the mirror around, turn our posters into mirrors, and turn it around and look at our cultures, and includes looking at ourselves. Are we contributing to a culture of death, a culture of accepting death? Because on one hand, in India, in spite of their laws, they say, yes, no, girl children, female children should not be aborted. No. People in general, faceless masses, should not abort their daughters in utero. And they should not leave their girl children in boxes by the side of the river to be exposed and killed by the elements or wild animals or whatever comes around. No, nobody should do that. But then they don't turn that and apply that to themselves. Let the girl children live, but not in my house. The not in my backyard, not in my house mentality kind of reigns supreme over and above any moralistic dictate that can ever be introduced. Yes, I'm sure most Chinese, even the government, will say, oh, yeah, we need female babies. Oh, yes, of course. Women are valued as much as men. But in reality, that's not how it is. And it's the reality that people refuse to admit. And here in the United States, as bad as that sounds, for people in another country to do that, it's worse when we look at it like it's another country. Oh, like it's not, it doesn't exist here. Of course, sex selection exists here in the United States. We have immigrants from those very countries. I'm one of them. You know, I'm a child of immigrants from a country like China, from China. You know, I thank God from the bottom of the knees that I pray with, that I bow down to. I thank God my parents emigrated away from China before the communist government was able to wrest control and take over the country. But had they lived beyond that point, there's a good chance that I and my sister and most of my cousins, my family is like 85% female. People are having daughters like crazy. My aunts and my cousins, we're having lots of girls. There's a good chance a good portion of my family would not exist. I would not have the nieces that I have. I wouldn't. Because of China's one-child policy. and that policy making it very hard for parents to raise just one girl when they value the son over the a daughter so much more. There's a good chance in the China boasts where we are trying to say it's a tragedy. Even the pro-choice people say it's a tragedy when we have so many aborted. Not that they really care, but they say it's a tragedy because we all know it's a tragedy. The Chinese government boasts 400 million babies having been aborted since their one-child policy had started in 1979. It's part of their family planning policies. If you don't plan to have your family limited to one child, they'll do it for you. It's family planning. I want you to get used to hearing it that way, because that's the end that every country kind of tumbles toward when population control meets a value for a particular sex or gender of a baby, sex determination. You combine those things, you have China's policies, and they're not apologetic about it. They will force women to have abortions up to 9 months gestation. They do it all the time. You only hear about it a fraction, if even a fraction of the time. So what has it led to? What has all this led to? Is it really that bad? Okay, so children are being aborted, as if that's not bad enough. Baby girls are being aborted at an alarming rate, such that the disparity in population between the number of women that are alive in China and the number of men that are alive in China is so great that there are 37 million men in China that will never find wives. 37 million. That's greater than 10%. That's probably 17% of the population of the United States. Of men that will never find spouses. They will never get married to anybody within China. They may have to look elsewhere. They might have to immigrate to a different country in order to find a wife. Or a lot of people resort to kidnapping. So what has the one-child policy married with a strong male preference wrought to China? It has wrought child kidnapping. It has wrought female gendercide. It has wrought abortion in female gendercide, infanticide, and prostitution and sex trafficking. I say kidnapping because girls are now looked at as property. If you have a girl and some other family has a boy, and this was in the film, they may kidnap the girl as a child. As a child. We're not talking about teenagers. We're not talking about grown women. They may kidnap that child, that girl, to raise as a future spouse for their son. Now, this is not like I'm going to adopt a baby girl. This is I'm kidnapping to keep her in my home until they're old enough to get married. And then I'll have a spouse for my son. You know, she's not a person. She's a female thing they have in her house that is waiting to grow up. And meanwhile, a family that is abided by the law, has a daughter, has lost their only child. Their only child, and they're going nuts trying to find her. Not only that, it has wrought sex trafficking as available women become less and less available. The market in finding spouses or just finding women who aren't supposed to be used, are not going to be used for spouses, grows, and women are trafficked to areas where there are mostly men because all the women have been killed to service men. And you know how that goes. That will happen. That is happening. And you might hear about it more. So I'm waiting. You know, I've heard about the disparity in populations and the male to female ratio in India almost 20 years ago when ultrasound technology first became more widespread use in India to determine whether or not they were going to abort a baby girl or not. So the ratio of men to women, the male to female ratio, began to widen at that point. And now all those men that were children when I first heard about this story, they're now grown and they probably want to get married, yet they still have a cultural dowry system, which, again, like all the other things, is against the law, but it still exists. The dowry is paid from the bride's family to the groom's family to enrich the groom's family. At least that's how it happens. I have heard an alternate theory, and I don't know if it's true, that the dowry is actually supposed to protect the bride in case the groom abandons her, so she has money to live on if anything goes wrong. However, in reality, I don't think it works that way. I don't think that's how it works out. So the dowry is paid to the groom's family to enrich the groom's family and him, and nothing is left for the bride, really, to protect her. I would like to see a reverse dowry being paid. Now that there is a marked shortage of eligible young ladies that are of marriageable age, I really think it is the groom's family's time to pay for the privilege of having a spouse for their son, because there are so few around, you know. But that's my ironic twist on that. What really needs to happen is the dowry system needs to break down completely. There is no price to be paid to the groom's family where he gets a wife and, you know, a portion of the family's property. I really don't know how that works in any way, or how that's come about, that it makes sense that if your daughter goes to live with her husband, that you send along so much property with her that actually goes to his family, it doesn't go to her. You're already losing a daughter. How can you lose your property too? I thought if this really is going to be a marriage, shouldn't the bride's family receive something and good faith for giving their daughter away to another family, that family has what it takes to take care of her, and I don't want to say compensates her family for her moving away, for giving her away, but in good faith shows them that they're going to be able to take care of her and them, you know, and kind of saying here's a going away present for your parents, who are no longer going to be living with you anymore. That we're going to share something with you because you've given your daughter away in marriage. That's just me. I just think that would be fair. At least, not just fair, it would be nice and compassionate. But maybe I'm asking too much. So in other words, I want people to see the film. If it comes out on DVD, if the film comes out in a theater local to you, go see it. I know that the TUG online registration program is or I don't know what it was called, TUGG, T-U-G-G, is the organization that brought the film to St. Louis to the theater that I was at last night. And so they needed an online registration, online ticket purchase in order to secure that date and have to meet a threshold. Ours was 66 seats, 66 tickets being sold. And we met it, and praise God that so many people got to see the film. So if it comes to your town or somewhere local to you, just be on the lookout for that. You may have to buy your ticket online in order to make sure that the film screening stays where it is. But I encourage everybody to watch that film. You will not regret it. You will not regret it. I don't know where you fall. I don't care where you fall in this issue of whether you approve of abortion or you approve or you are pro-life and you oppose abortion. You need to see this film because this is a reality that's happening. And as a teaser, if you are particularly liberal and pro-abortion and, you know, politically liberal, you would love this segment where Hillary Clinton has a cameo appearance in the film. Just want to throw that out there. Hallelujah. All right. In other news, before we go for today, we just have a few minutes left. Oh, let's see. More stuff. The UN, Human Rights Council. You're going to love this. The UN Human Rights Council ditches the pro-family measure, which they had on the books, in order to promote abortion. What did you think I'd say? Hot dogs? The Human Rights Council set aside a resolution to protect the family as member states focused instead on a controversial resolution which would, could expose children to early sexualization and abortion and would undermine the rights of parents. This is in Geneva, Switzerland, and I'm reading from lifenews.com. Western nations did their best to make sure a resolution on protection of the family was not adopted at the session of the council that concluded March 22nd. The resolution builds on recent resolutions that recognize the family as the natural and fundamental group unit of society. An urgent alert from the Association for Women's Rights in Development, AWID, a group that promotes abortion and sexual rights, suggests why Western nations don't like family policies. Now, let me stop to stress the fact that it does say Western nations. Okay. AWID denounced the family resolution as the, quote, thin end of the wedge, unquote, that will undermine access to abortion and homosexual rights. A, quote, ploy to cement the traditional family as a subject of human rights protection in and of itself, unquote. UN treaties already recognize the family composed of man and a woman, as well as other forms of families, as a subject of rights, not families, headed by homosexual couples. Okay. If you're a logic chopper like I am, who likes to send statements, attitudes like this through, in light of what we just talked about, women in prison because they are Christians, being tortured mentally and physically. Christians who are in prison being tortured mentally and physically. Political dissidents, people of all kinds of strength who have not committed any civil crimes being in prison for their beliefs. And girls being killed because they're girls, whether you're in the womb, just out of the womb, or even a little bit older because you die of neglect. In light of this, how is it that the UN's Human Rights Council can claim to stand up for anyone's human rights if they set aside the idea that families are our natural protection and the best way to raise men and women that don't believe in abortion as a way of sex selecting their way to happiness, How can a human rights council do this? Affirm abortion to undermine their basic fundamental reason for being. The Human Rights Council is supposed to stand up for the human rights of everybody. It's being the United Nations, the human rights of women and children and men in the United Nations. I don't know. Seems like a contradiction to me. It should seem like a contradiction to you. So with that, I'm going to tell everybody that next week we have a great show planned. We've got some really good guests for the next few weeks. We haven't confirmed them all, so I'm not going to say who they are right ahead, but we've got big plans. And I want people to understand what's coming up. The Pro-Life Without Exceptions Conference is coming up in June. Please clear your calendars. If you are pro-life of any stripe, we want you to attend the conference because it's going to knock your socks off. It really is going to knock your socks off. Okay. With that, I want to say goodbye to my co-host, Thomas Smith, who I think his phone died. So that's why you haven't heard from him. His phone died and he had to leave the conversation. I want to thank our guests one more time, Miriam and Marzia, coming on this show. That really just warmed my heart. Thank you, audience, for listening to Pro-Life Fridays Radio here on Blog Talk Radio and the Invisible Conservative Show. And tune in next week as we are back at 5 o'clock on Fridays, Pro-Life Fridays. So have a good night. We will talk to you again.
Sex education. Break down their natural modesty, separate them from their parents and their values, and become the sex expert in their life so they turn to us. When we would give them a low-dose birth control pill they would get pregnant on, or a defective condom. Our goal was 3 to 5 abortions from every girl between the ages of 13 and 18.
The multitudes of people that have been hurt by abortion, it's just unfathomable.
That abortion is really, to me, the ultimate exploitation of women.
It is so shameful and secretive that many women don't tell anybody that they've had an abortion.
They won't say anything for 20, 30, 40, 55 years. They're so traumatized, silence.
The U.S. Senate report states, physicians, biologists, and other scientists agree that conception marks the beginning of the life of a being that is alive and is a member of the human species. There is an overwhelming agreement on this point in countless medical, biological, and scientific writings.
Planned Parenthood is expanding now. They're building gigantic abortion clinics in anticipation of socialized medicine.
There's a lot of money involved. We never would take personal checks. We always encourage the ladies to bring cash.
Why is that?
So, well, you don't have to report cash, friend.
When you're fighting for your life, you need to know what you're fighting for. And if what you're fighting for is life, how do you destroy a life in an effort to fight that fight? I'm fighting so hard to save myself that I'll kill someone else to get that.
I recognized I'd been involved in the death of 35,000 babies.
and the truth has really come out about what abortion does to women, let alone the unborn baby, our dead babies, it will be over.